You're listening to the public feed of Carefree Highway Revisited, which includes only a portion of this conversation. To hear the complete discussion, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or see the show notes for details.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
Then the ship Bahama Star comes steaming through the night. She sees the castle blazon, and 'tis a terrible sight. Jump down, the captain cries. We'll save you if we can. Now, this one was about as far away behind the Yarmouth Castle as the Finnepulp was ahead of it. The captain saw the fire about 2:15 in the morning. By that time, the fire had been going on for some time. They stopped about 100 yards from the Yarmouth Castle, and they launched their own lifeboat for the passengers. And by this time, the passengers on the Yarmouth Castle were getting off any way they could, either jumping in or hanging onto the lifeboats that could be launched because not all of the lifeboats were available. They were trapped behind fire, or maybe they were on fire themselves. So the Bahama Star was the only one that was mentioned, but it was the second ship on the scene, not the only one.
Interestingly enough, this is a place where Lightfoot had an opportunity to have a much more dramatic scene just depicted, because by some accounts, Bahama Star actually came up alongside the vessel so people could go directly from the Yarmouth Castle to Bahama Star until the fire got too much for Bahama Star and she pulled away. And so part of the people jumping off of the Yarmouth Castle was because the Bahama Star had to pull away and was no longer jumped directly onto the vessel. But just imagine the scene. You have a ship ablaze, you have another ship pulling up alongside, literally alongside, in order to assert a rescue. And this is one of those things where life would be almost too dramatic for a song. At this point, you're wondering if you describe that, would people actually believe it?
Well, the other thing that I think of for this is that if I'm putting myself in the shoes of a passenger on the Yarmouth Castle and here's this ship, you know, if I take two or three steps back, I could probably leap from one ship onto the other, all things being equal. And now all of a sudden I see that pulling away for its own survival. I mean, I don't know what's going on. All I know is that I'm being abandoned. I'm going to die.
Again.
There's hope, and now the hope has been completely shattered. I would think that would be the most devastating psychological aspect. Being in a ship that's on fire is scary enough, but then to have your only hope be snatched away from you, I can't even imagine, you know, how devastating that was. God help the ones who sleep below and cannot find the way. Thank God for those we've rescued upon this awful day. Well, to make an end to the story, about 2:30 a.m., the U.S. Coast Guard started sending planes and helicopters, and they got all of the survivors by about 4 o'clock in the morning off the ship. And the Yarmouth Castle sank at about 6:03 a.m., and I don't think they ever actually recovered the remains of the ship. I think it's still at the bottom of the Atlantic. The total that died, 87 people went down with the ship. Most of their bodies were never recovered. And then 3 died of their injuries later at hospitals in either the Bahamas or the United States. I don't know where. Oh, the Yarmouth Castle's moaning. She's crying like a child. You can hear her if you listen above the roar so wild. Is she crying for the ones who lie between her molten sides? Or crying for herself, I'm a wondering. And this goes back to, you didn't use this word before, but the spirituality behind shipwrecks, behind anything having to do with the sea, but especially shipwrecks. It's mourning the ones that were lost, but it's also mourning its own demise. It's great personification, and it's not just giving a voice, it's now giving emotion to this object. So it's taking on functional attributes, but it's also taking on emotional attributes. And I don't think I've seen examples of that related to a ship in most other literature that I've ever heard or seen.
I want to say, though, that this is my second favorite line. And the reason for it is because it really goes back to the injustice of running the ship so far beyond her prime. The best thing you can hope for a ship is that she has a good long life and she makes it home safely and is scrapped and parts of her reused into new stuff. The most honorable thing for a ship is for the ship to make her last run and bring everyone home. And here we have this personification of a ship that was denied this honor. And is she crying for herself? Is she crying for her passengers? The answer is yes. I firmly believe the answer is yes. And I love the fact that the question is asked.
I absolutely agree with you. And this is one of my favorite lines of the whole thing too, the one that we were just talking about. One more thing on the technical aspect of this before we talk about the context of the song in the album. You mentioned that the Yarmouth Castle was mostly a wooden superstructure.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't that also something that was changed with the international laws about survival of persons at sea, that you yes. couldn't do wooden superstructures anymore?
Yes. And it was actually something that had changed for American vessels beforehand. That's why she was retired from the American fleet, and why she was reflagged in Panama, is we weren't doing that for our passenger vessels by that point in time.
Well, the song was on the Sunday Concert album in 1969. It was his fifth original album. This was a song that was probably played a little later in the concert. It was the number seven track. It was on side B. I think it may have been the first song on side B. It wasn't released as a single, but then there were no singles that were released from this album. The album didn't chart in Australia or the UK. It got to 21 in Canada, and it got to number 143 on the Billboard 200. So this is still relatively early in Lightfoot's career. I think it was his first live album. He's made two or three of them, I think. What to you from the Sunday Concert album, what is your favorite musical aspect of the song?
This is going to seem uncharitable to me, but I think the musical aspect I love about it is its potential. And I say this because I don't think that Gordon Lightfoot knew what he had in this song. It's fair, it's easy, but see, he writes so many good stuff. I could easily see it being very easy to overlook the stuff that doesn't make itself obviously known. But the song is a prototype for The Wreck of Edmund Fitzgerald. In many ways, it's a better story because there is a villain. There is survivors. The material he had to work with is fantastic.
Well, survivors, but, and not just victims.
Yeah, yeah. The material he had to work with is fantastic for this story, but it doesn't have the repeating eighth notes on top of full bars. It doesn't have that percussion, and it doesn't have the music that will keep you going if you're not really into lyrics that the Wreck of Edmund Fitzgerald has. Has a lovely folk ballad sound. It's someone who is writing a folk ballad, which works well when you are used to sitting by a fire and listening to someone sing for an hour. It's a very basic arrangement. It's a very simple arrangement. There's a lot musically going into it. It's very pleasant, but it doesn't have the energy. I don't think it would have gotten on an album if you hadn't had it in that concert. And one of the things that's amazing to me about the song is that I did not learn it from him. I learned it in the living room, listening to someone else who's responsible for teaching me a lot about history that I didn't learn in school. And it's something that he kind of threw out there, and it's grown its own. It hasn't been covered by that many people. But in a sense, it's the closest thing to a true folk song he's written, because most of the people who know it don't actually know the origin. I mean, a lot of the other stuff that he's written has gone into the folk canon, but we all can reference the original source. In this one, he just kind of laid it out there in this album and then did nothing else with it, which is fascinating because it's such a good song.
You know, I kind of seen him putting this on an album if his first album, I guess, came out in 1966, and I think he probably could have found a place for it on one of his first two, either, I guess, The Way I Feel or the original Lightfoot record, because they are very much in, as you say, the folk canon, the folk style. And it was a popular thing to write story songs like this in the mid-60s. That being said, when I listen to this particular version of it, it's stripped down,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like there's something missing. in the arrangement. I don't know what it is. I can't explain it. I couldn't tell you, well, it needs X or it needs Y. But it just, to me, there was some element that wasn't there. And again, I couldn't even tell you, well, what about this instrument or that instrument? The finger picking is great. Rick Haynes has a very understated bass at that point. I thought Red's lead guitar was all right.
So what's missing is session musicians. I mean, if it was on the first two albums, it was a live performance. And with a live performance, you have the nature of the performer and the audience, and you have an energy that you don't get in session work. But it's a different type of collaboration than you have with session musicians. And if you had the same backing that he did, the same sort of, okay, we have 2 hours in the studio. We have a whole bunch of people whose job it is to make those 2 hours count, make this song work, as opposed to a live performance where I'm sharing with you the song that I have written. So there's a very different energy there. And generally live albums are better, but this is a folk song. This is a folk ballad. And if it was going to have a chance from an economic perspective, it needed to have the dose of economic reality that session work gives.
Well, that and the fact that the more pieces you add to a stage performance, that means you have that much more to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how well you've rehearsed, there's always the chance that somebody's attention is going to lapse for a minute. You're going to have to maybe abandon the whole track if it doesn't come out real well, because we didn't have the same kind of recording technology to fix things that we'd have in later years. You didn't have that in 1969. Well, that's all the time we have for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this conversation, along with all of our other extended and bonus episodes, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com. You can see the show notes for details.